Yes, but never really trapped. Always it looks like it's going to happen, but it never does. Who's fooling around all this stuff here? Come on, come on. Let's go here. Let's get it going. You know? Listen, I want to say before we begin tonight that is there anyone listening tonight? No, I guess it doesn't matter. I don't want to bring that up yet. Did you see the little piece in the paper? You know, you live... What's the matter? What are you hooked on? Oh, don't worry about that. I love people who get all excited over the nothings and completely ignore the big things. Oh, yes. What I was going to say was, since it is middle of the week and we might as well get with it here, comedy is a difficult world, difficult field to deal with. And the things that happen to people rarely, that is, in films, rarely happen in life. I wonder whether literature ever touches upon our existence. What's everybody breathing so hard for in there? What's going on? Come on, let's all just calm down here for a minute. Let's do the radio show. Just take it easy. It's all right now. Pretend you're out at Coney Island and all the problems are over, okay? Everybody now, just relax here for a minute. It's all okay now. I said, what here? Look up. Come on. What's wrong with you? Don't write. You don't copy everything down that's said. Just sit there and listen. Once in a while, we have this trouble with all the people. You know, the little spines get raised up and little hackles are up. But anyway, I'm reading. Have you ever read a news note where it suddenly hits you so much? Well, I'll tell you something happened to me last night at 4 o'clock in the morning. No, don't write down 4 o'clock in the morning. You're getting too detailed. I was going to tell you that about your notes. The trick is not to transcribe, but to make notes. That's a very big difference. I remember one time when I was taking a class in sociology, learning how to make notes is a very difficult thing. Because when I first started to take notes in college, I started to take notes in a sociology class, and I wound up trying to write down the guy's whole lectures as he went. Well, as a net result, I didn't listen to anything. I just wrote like mad for one complete semester and flunked. And I had a voluminous 400-volume notebook, but I failed the course because I did not know how to take notes. Notes, in a sense, are the quintessence of compression. One word says what a whole sentence expressed. All right, now let's get back to it. Anyway, at 4 o'clock in the morning, which was this morning, I'm looking at a newspaper, and I'm just sort of, you know, just nothing time. I'm just looking at the paper. And I've gone through all the stuff, you know, the business of Laos, and I'm down there having the problem with the Venus moonshot or the rocket shot or the whatever that thing is that's going out there that's going to bring us back all this great information and stuff. And I'm reading all this, and I'm going along, and things, you know, it's just the newspaper. It's like all newspapers, only it's today. That's the only big thing it has to offer is that it's now a newspaper. And, oh, incidentally, a kid was writing me the other day, and he says, Shepherd, speaking of newspapers, he says, Shepherd, and I'm going to quote this letter exactly. I brought it in here, and let's see, where is it? Yeah, here it is. He says, Shepherd, I looked in the New York Times, and you are not listed under music, news, sports, talk, or drama. What the hell are you? That's all the kid said. Excuse the expression, but I'm quoting the kid here. And if, you know, this is the way he said it. I hope I didn't offend you with the language. This 16-year-old kid said this, but nevertheless, he is right. That in the Times they have things listed under, in radio, the Radio Times listing says music, drama, talk, and news, and the only thing they mean by talk is interviews. That's why, kid, I'm not listed. I'm none of those things. I'm not talk, I'm not drama, I'm not music, and I'm not news. I'll tell you, let's all write to the Times and ask the Times, what is Shepherd? I mean, he's not listed under any of those things, and they have all kinds of trivial little radio shows listed under all these various things. So it's not a matter of making a decision as to whether a show is good or bad any longer. It's just that I guess they can't catalog me. Am I talk, friends? Am I music, news, drama? Am I excitement? No, that's a serious question. I am not listed any longer at all in the New York Times. You know, there was a day, I'll never forget the day when I was awarded my star in the Times. Well, that's been a long time ago. Oh, boy, we'll sit here and recount all the old battles. And a few years ago, when the New York Times listed radio programs, And they used to have a star, you know, this radio programs with unusual interest. And so one day, just out of the blue, I got a star. And I continued to have a star next to my name. It was the first star that I had had since Miss Shields gave me that star for making slant lines so good back in second grade. And I was thrilled, you know. It isn't very often that a guy gets a star after his name. You know, just a little thing, you know. These little things count in a world where little things count. I mean, you know, what else do we have? How do any of us have anything like that? How many stars have you had next to your name in the Times? I ask you. So, you know, I mean, I don't win Emmys. I'm not on the cover of TV Guide. And, you know, I'm not in any of these things. And it was a wonderful thing to have that little black star every week. And every Sunday, I would look at the Times real frantically, you know. It would come out at Saturday night. I'd go through the Times, and there would be all this little scare, you know. See, and sure enough, there would be my star, and I would feel great. My weekend would be made, and I'd work the puzzle with such fantastic confidence after that, you know, those big 27-letter words meaning Shoshone Indian Chief. None of that stuff ever threw me. After that, after my star. Well, one day, again, just like out of the blue, the thing hit again. It was a lightning struck, and just with no explanation, just with a cavalier sweep of the pen, my star was gone. Just pow, no star. What did I do to the Times? I don't know. Well, so I said, well, okay, my star is gone. Well, all right. But I was there anyway, still listed there on the radio programs, along with top 40 favorites, along with all the other stuff. I was listed anyway, in small type, but listed. And then came that terrible day when they even removed the listing completely. And now they have these categories: music, talk, news, sports, and drama. And I am not in any one of them. I no longer exist as far as the Times is concerned. I am now a non-existent entity. So slowly but surely, the vast millstones of the gods grind. And who can deny that the New York Times is one of our gods? Slowly but surely, the millstones of the gods grind, but they grind exceedingly fine. And once having ground, never go back to regrind. I'm gone. You understand that? Gone. Times, I'm still here, Times. I'm not drama, that's true. I'm certainly not news, but I'd question that. I am talk Times sometimes, not often, but I make sense. Well, I guess that's true. I don't interview senators or guys who have just invented a new elliptical single-cycle engine or are going to Venus by flapping their arms. I don't do any of those important things, Times. That's true. And music, no. I'm fed to the teeth with music, Times. That's all we've got on the crummy radio. Music all day long. Music everywhere. No, I don't do that. And sports, well, I don't know. I guess I'm not a sport either. In fact, I'm notoriously a bad sport. So I would just be curious what the Times says to you. Will one of you guys write? I can't do it. It'd be too embarrassing for me. Well, will one of you, or maybe five of you, write to the Times and say, Times, we'd just like to ask you a rhetorical question. What is Shepherd? If he is not music, news, drama, sports, or talk, what is he? Just thought we'd ask. And see, I'd love to see what they say to you, if anything. Although one of my listeners wrote, and he says, I don't write to the Times anymore. Boy, they sure get mad when you say something about them. He says, they get madder than any paper in town if you write and say, you know, that was a goofy article you wrote there about the Bronx is now in a sweat because television has turned off. He says, look out for the Times. They'll bat you right down. Who do you think, you know? I mean, you don't argue with headquarters. You know, speaking of arguing with headquarters, anyway, it was at 4 o'clock in the morning. See, nothing is happening. My brain is working at 1/10 mast, and there's a little buzz in the ears, and I'm just reading the paper, and all of a sudden I came along with this fantastic item in the Herald Tribune Times, in the Trib, and it's from Shamokin, Pennsylvania, AP. Listen to this. The town of Tharptown in Pennsylvania got an unexpected whitewash Monday due to a highways employee who meant only to paint new divider lines along Route 122. Listen to this story. It's the greatest news story to come along. Well, listen just here. A hose connected to an automatic line painter sprung a leak as the unidentified worker drove right through the center of town. Quick drying white paint gushed from a 200-gallon pressurized tank onto the road, sidewalks, fences, lawns, flowers, hedges, cars, trucks, and people. Police said that the worker traveled at least 2 miles, almost the entire length of the town of Tharptown, before screaming people and honking automobile horns alerted him that something was wrong. By then it was too late. At least 5 cars, 2 trucks were whitewashed completely, including a brand new sleek black convertible with its windows rolled down. Many people were completely whitewashed from head to toe. All the way, there was no immediate estimate of damage. I want it there! Hold it there! Great. I think that's a beautiful story. I mean, that's right out of a Laurel and Hardy comedy. You know, it's just the kind of stuff that I can just see a guy in the Mack Sennett lot. I'll tell you what we'll do. Out this guy, you know, and he's squirting with the lines over. Shh! The white paint squirts out. The cops are running down the street. The convertible, the guy's sitting there waiting for his girl. Shh! In it comes. Of course, everybody laughs. Is there anybody listening from Tharptown, Pennsylvania? I'd just like to hear I know, they get us in Shamokin. I can continually get letters from Shamokin. Does anyone know about this? What? And they did not identify the worker. His name was reputedly Oliver Hardy. Speaking of buffoons, this is WOR, AM and FM New York, and we'll be here until, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, speaking of these great moments, and as long as we're concerned, do you realize right now, at this very minute, at this very instant, there is something that we created here on Earth that is on its way to Venus. Well, now, that's an interesting thing to think about. This is not a rhetorical question, but it is actually happening. This thing, it's hard to conceive of it, but this thing is out there, probably a million miles away now, and it's steadily moving away from the Earth and will never be back here, ever get back here again, you know. After it passes Venus, you know what it's going to do. It's going to go into orbit around the sun. Oh, by the way, speaking of going into orbit, are you aware that one of the new problems that is being faced by scientists is the obvious problem of garbage in orbit around the Earth? Yes, garbage. I'm talking about just worthless gunk, junk, garbage that's now orbiting all around the Earth, including tail fins, back ends of rockets, all kinds of stuff. You know, when they put up a satellite, the equipment that sends the satellite up also goes into orbit. You're aware of that, you know. So the satellite is orbiting around, and all the gunk that brought it up there is orbiting around with it. Big bodies of spent rockets and tail fins and control sections and all this. And it's all floating around out there in orbit. And once in a while, of course, some of it coasts down and burns up and comes back into our atmosphere. But right now, they figure that there are over 1,000 pieces of hardware just sailing around continually, just sailing around endlessly around the Earth. And some of those pieces of hardware, they estimate, will be up there as long as 3 or 4 centuries before they return, because they were on a certain orbital path that made them so that they will not return for that time. They just continue to orbit round and round. Now, as we increase the speed of our experiments, as we send up more and more stuff, of course, there's going to be more and more gunk floating around there endlessly. And this is a fascinating thing. Do you realize that people 300 or 400 years from now are going to discover, of course, they will be doing all kinds of traffic in space. I'm sure that 300 or 400 years from now, they will discover garbage and claptrap and gunk from our experiments out there in space, and somebody will rescue some of that stuff. And this will be like museum pieces of the future. Just like when skin divers will dive, you know, and they'll dive off the coast of Greenland, and they will come up with a Viking ship, which was an artifact of the days of exploration of a past period. Now, these people, of course, had no idea that people would be digging up their ships 1,000 years hence and putting them in museums and making a big fuss over them. They were just a ship, you know. A bunch of guys got on this thing they built, and they started out, and they headed towards Greenland. Well, one day they ran into the hurricane, and that was the end of it. Down they went, and that was it. But they will be pulling in tail fins, and these things will be very, very old by then, you see. By then, they really will belong to almost the prehistoric days of space work and space travel. Now, it's interesting to realize that some of these these pieces of equipment. The Russians have a couple of them, you know, out. We're not the first to send stuff towards Venus. You know, the Russians did it. And in fact, one of the Russian rockets, one of their probes, is now in orbit, as far as I understand, around the sun. We have a couple of things in orbit around the sun, but this is a major one that was a probe towards Venus. That's an exciting phrase, probe. They don't even describe them as rockets anymore. They call them a Venus probe. It's probing towards Venus. We betray ourselves in a lot of interesting ways in our language. Probe, something to reach out and touch with. But nevertheless, this rocket that's now out there, this piece of equipment, which weighs about 450 pounds, are you aware of that? That's the total weight of the equipment that is riding out there towards Venus. It will go into orbit around the sun on a tremendous elliptical orbit around the sun. Well, eventually, someday, it is... Oh, incidentally, they also feel that this is going to orbit forever around the sun, that it will become literally a satellite to the sun, just the way the moon is a satellite to the Earth, and it just orbits around us continually, always at a set pace and a set distance from us. And so this Venus probe will do this around the sun. Now, one day, somebody's going to discover that out there, maybe 100,000 years from now. And the records of that probe will have been lost, I'm sure, because it's hard for us to realize it, but this time will pass, you know, 100,000 years. They still won't be reading the mirror, you know, that time. And America will have been forgotten a long time by then, I'm sure. And in fact, it's interesting to realize that most of the countries that we know are only a few thousand years old. How old do you think England is? It's just a, it's not a, what is it? England really didn't come into being until around the 10th century or so, as we know it. And that's the 10th century A.D. So you realize that most of the countries that we know and most of the social structures we know are just 1,000 or 2,000 years at the most old. Well, I'm talking in terms of 100,000 years, and so it's quite obvious that the United States will no longer exist then, nor will England, nor will Russia, nor will any of the social structures that we consider immutable and blessed by God, by the way. We usually consider most of these things. Hey, do you realize that almost every country believes that God is on its side? Every God-fearing country? Are you aware of that? Well, they really do. You go to a place like Beirut, and they speak of the country that God has blessed, and it is the one country that God realizes is the good country among all of them. They really do, and this is part of their daily prayers. It sounds very familiar, doesn't it? You hear that every Sunday night on all kinds of little radio stations. You also hear it, it's part of most of the political diatribes that you hear people speak. And I'm sure that every other country in its own way feels that it is the chosen people, and certainly the chosen country. Even the Gobi Desert tribes do. They feel this. They figure, you know, there's a certain amount of value in that sand, too. Now, though, getting back to the point, though, it's intriguing. Why do we have to go to Venus? Well, I have a theory. I have a theory, and I'm about to express it. It is a blindingly dull theory, but my theory is this: that the time that man has spent on Earth is comparatively tiny compared to the geological time when you measure the length of time that the Earth itself has been in existence. In other words, how old is the planet? Well, the planet is around 3 billion years old, or at least that's the latest estimate, between 2 and 3 billion years. Now, the estimate as to how long man has been around in his present form is less than 500,000 years, and I'm talking about in his present form. Now, the very beginning origins of man, they claim, go back something like between 1 million and 2 million years, which is a tiny pimple on the you-know-what of the camel of the universe, when you stop to realize that the Earth itself has been in business about 3 billion years. Now, a billion, I suppose you understand how many millions a billion is, so we don't have to go into numbers. However, let us get to the point of it. I suspect that since the Earth has continually changed from the very first day of its creation, continually changed in temperature, in composition, it's changed even, see, because you have to consider the Earth, not only just the Earth you stand on, but the total Earth also includes the envelope of air and gases that surround it. This is part of the Earth. These are elements that are in gaseous states and are as much a part of the earth as the sand and the water, which are in solid states or liquid. But this has always been in a constant state of flux. Now, it has continually been evolving towards another kind of thing. The earth has changed temperature from the very beginnings of its origin. It started as this gigantic flaming ball, and it will continue to change temperature all the way on till the final day when it loses its temperature completely. And then there is the sure knowledge that the earth slowly moving in towards the sun will eventually be destroyed by fire totally. The earth itself will burn up as it's getting closer to the sun. Well, now, what this means, and there have been several psychologists and sociologists have been working on this interesting problem, is that man has been possible only because of a certain phase through which the earth is evolving. In other words, the time became ripe geologically and geographically for this creature to exist. Now, we can exist only under a certain set of conditions, and they're very narrow compared to geological narrowness. Now, here's what I mean by that, that some temperatures can go as high on certain planets as, let's say, 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Others will go down close to absolute zero. Absolute zero, of course, being absolute zero centigrade, or a total lack of movement among any molecules anywhere. That's absolute theoretical zero. Now, man can exist as a creature only under a certain set of very limited conditions. Like, say, he can exist up to about 60 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, and he can exist to roughly 110 or 115 degrees above zero Fahrenheit. Now, he can control his environment to make it possible to live just a little more. He can just expand those a little more by electrical and mechanical means. So, in a temperature of, let's say, 150 degrees by mechanical means, he can bring it down to roughly 110, thereby allowing him to live. When it gets to 200 degrees below zero, he can raise the temperature to about zero, and there he will live too. But no one knows quite what will happen when the temperature is, let's say, 6,000 degrees, or 5,000, or 10,000, or 20,000 degrees. Now, we are evolving towards, and I'm talking about in long spaces of time compared to the human life span, our little 70 years, which is trivia compared to the whole sum. However, the interesting thing about it is that it has been said by many philosophers that the length, and by astronomers too, that the length of time that man will be able to exist on this earth is very short compared to the length of time that the earth will actually itself be in existence. That means for one brief instant in the earth's time before the earth burns up, it was possible for camels and men to exist. Now, here is the theory. I say this. I say that we all have a secret knowledge of this. I say that we have an unconscious knowledge of the short time. It's as though all of man is one man. And this all of man is concerned not with the individual lifespan in this case, but he's concerned with the individual, with the life of all men. Do you understand what I'm saying? That we are just cells in a great body, the body being mankind. And it's even greater than that. We are just cells in a great body of growing organisms, or life organisms that include zebras, cats, turtles, and plants. And we are just one type of cell in that great growing thing. Now, it's as though you are two things at the same time. You are a man, you are Charlie. But you are also part of a bigger thing, which is mankind. Now, mankind, if you can follow this, mankind has, on toto, a mass man sense. A sense of, it's as though mankind exists separately from you, and yet you are part of it. It's like General Motors will continue to go on after you are dead, even though you are a big wheel in the order department of General Motors now. Do you understand? The GM, and GM will also have a corporate personality that exists separately from the men in it. Now, General Motors is a different kind of corporation. You can just see it as a man, as, let's say, opposed to Aerojet General. You follow me there? that the corporate body, you don't. Well, it is. All right. Now, so here's what I say. I say that it's this other side of us that is vaguely aware that time is running out. It's like an old man who is 62 years old and he knows that he cannot live much beyond 70. He knows it. Now, he does not really say this to himself, I know it, I'm going to die. It's very few men have that kind of guts that they say that I'm going to die, I'm 62, and consciously look for an escape. He begins to unconsciously look for it. Like, for example, he will try to run away from his wife and become thereby young again. Or he will try to write a book. He will try to endow a library somehow. He will have a terrible desire to endow an orphanage. he will do all these things, you see. It's a subconscious desire somehow to escape death. Well, now, I think that this corporeal thing, which is all of us, this great thing, mankind, knows secretly that the earth is running out of gas and we have a limited time on earth. So he's frantically looking for a way out. That all of us are frantically trying to get the devil out of this thing before it finally burns up. It's like the house is burning down. And so we're frantically trying to look for something. Now, if we get near Venus, now I'm going to give you a hypothetical answer now about what the information shall be from Venus. Now, if this thing whistles past Venus and it radios back, the temperature on Venus is 20,000 degrees. The atmosphere is composed entirely of gigantic drops of ammonia. Well, there would be a universal sense of, oh, what a drag. Why? Instead of it being a fantastically interesting thing, because it would be interesting to realize that here is a planet with a temperature of 10,000 degrees and an atmosphere of ammonia, it would disappoint us. Why? Well, I can tell you why. Because it means then one avenue of escape is blocked. We ain't going there. Well, let's start on Saturn now. And we'll start another one, you see. And it's going to go on and on and on and on until we find an escape. Until we find an escape. Now that escape, it will never affect you and me. Just as the man who is endowing the library for future generations when he is 78 years old and about to die, he will never read those books. But there is a terrible urge for him to do it anyway. To somehow escape death. And so it would be a comforting feeling for us to know that when the earth blows up, as it will eventually when it runs into the sun, 2.5 billion years from now, men will safely be on Pluto. And the Ed Sullivan Show will go on. Yep. And your stock is going to be good. The one of the first companies to land, I understand, in the third galaxy from the left, the one just beside Arcturus 7, will be Ford. And they'll be on the big board there. Don't worry. So your stock is going to be okay. Everyone, you know, it's hard for us to conceive of institutions which seem to be so absolutely impregnable and solid. It's hard for us to conceive of them finally completely petering out and dissolving and then completely being lost to the memory of man. Can you imagine, say, well, let's take our whole business structure. One day could be completely forgotten. You know where you get these terrible feelings? See, you get these from traveling. I'll never forget one day standing at dusk. It was a very peculiar moment. I'm standing at dusk in the Forum. And that ain't the restaurant, Daddy, of the same name. I'm standing in the Forum in Rome. Well, there it was, you know, and you know what the Forum is like to stand in? Well, it's a very strange thing, actually. It is not the way the movies show it. Audrey Hepburn is not playing hide-and-seek with Cary Grant among the Roman columns there. That whole jazz that Hollywood has made of Rome doesn't make it when you're there. It's silly, trivial, and idiotic. And you're standing, oh yes, you know, Sophia Loren doesn't come skulking out of the catacombs with Vittoria De Sica after her. It's a very different thing. So I'm standing there in the middle of this, and this goes arching up into the hills, and it's twilight, and there's this faint wind blowing down from the hills. And down at the far end, I had just come from the far end where they had made another discovery of a group of tombs that were just prior to the time of Julius Caesar. And they were laying down there, and you could see where people had been digging. And one on the other, you can look, if you look off to your right, if you're facing a particular direction in the forum, you can see where one church has been built on the other, going all the way back to an ancient Roman temple. And finally, the Byzantine church rises until eventually it gets all the way on up to the top, and there's a TV antenna sticking out of it. Well, the thing that bugs you about it all is that they are all gone, without exception, all of them. And what was even more important, the entire structure of what they had is also gone. There was a very complicated political, social, and economic life in Rome. And during those days, it was as complicated and as ritualized and as stylized and apparently as long-lived. And certainly it seemed to be as permanent as ours does to them. And yet they are all gone, and so is it. And there is only one thing left, just a few stones. And the weeds grow and the cats roam. And there it is, and the wind blows across it, and not a single thing is left from it. Not one. Well, what's even more intriguing is when you look and see the great temples of worship. This was built over a long period of time, as far as we know time even. Like 100 years to build one of these temples. Because they ground the stone out by hand. And there was this great structure of a religious, tremendous religious hierarchy all built up, gone. As far as I know, there isn't a single person today who worships Jupiter. Not one. Or Athena. Not a single one. And there it was. It's all gone. It has disappeared. The wind has blown it away. And all that remains are the stones. Well, it is a difficult thing to conceive of that happening, or this accumulation of time, which slowly is piling up on us, just like a great drift, like a snow drift, just pushing it in on us, higher and higher and higher it goes, until finally there is nothing left. Now we feel, you see, the interesting thing about man is that he feels that he can cure it all. That not only can he beat time, he can beat temperature, he can beat it all. Because he has managed for a brief period of time to hold the forces at bay, seemingly. But you know what made me think about a lot of this stuff? I got a wild letter from a kid, and I want to read this letter to you. It's just from a kid. Now, let me dig this thing out if I can. Why do I keep coming in here without my stuff? Oh, boy, I'm telling you. Well, anyway, I'll just have to drop that because I left it somewhere. I didn't bring it with me. Well, anyway, the thing that got me about, see how I had it down there. I tell you, maybe you can go down and get it. It's on my desk, right in the middle of the desk, and it's a typewritten letter. Now listen to me. It's a kid starts out and he says, "Dear Shepherd, we just had a tornado. Hurry. I don't have time to fool around with it." But, no, it's not here. I came up here really prepared, didn't I? But the thing that intrigued me about it was the seeming sense of security that all of us get with our air conditioners going, with our automobiles going. And by the way, speaking of automobiles, did you hear about that wild accident here on 41st Street yesterday? You read about it in the paper? Well, there's another triumph of automation. As an old line driver, and I don't level any accusations or anything, but as an old line driver, I recognized immediately this is one of the great ills of the automatic transmission. Did you read what the thing did? How it hurtled across the street? Obviously, this is an automatic transmission, and they were sitting there, and somebody stepped on the gas, and away she went. I think in some ways we are going to automate ourselves into some pretty interesting problems. And some of these problems are going to be so fantastically insurmountable that we can't even conceive of them, even at this point. I don't think we're even near conceiving of what these things are going to finally lead us to. In fact, there's a great article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine as long as we're on the subject, and while Lee is down there trying to pick up that letter, there's a great article in Harper's Magazine, this current issue, and this is not a commercial, about the new phenomenon of automation, and that's the creation of what they have termed unwork. It's a fascinating concept. Unwork is little things that give men things to do while the machines are doing the real stuff. In other words, the unions have come along and said, look, the machines are coming in, what are we going to do? And so there are thousands of men today working in different industries, as well as offices today, doing dummy jobs. Just, they set up type and then they throw it out. It's just to give men something to do while the machines quietly hum away. But the one thing that has never been really approached by this unwork problem is the humiliation that is going to be felt by all of us when eventually we are totally useless. I foresee the day, actually, Ed, right here in our industry, when radio is so automated, when it's going to be one gigantic tape, when you and I or people like us will be sitting in dummy radio studios doing dummy radio programs that will be fed into non-existent dummy monitor speakers. And all the while, the real thing will be operating quietly and ticking it off. And I assume, of course, in the end, that it will be listened to by dummy listeners. The automatic listener. I'm looking forward to the day when there will be automatic viewing machines on television sets that will watch the TV shows for you, that will tell you whether you missed a good one or if you should have seen it. And the machine will automatically decide if it was a good one. It will record it so that then it can show it to you later. I predict that machine. I do. I really do. I predict that machine. Oh, here is what made me think of this whole phenomenon right here. A kid. Now, I want you to listen carefully. This is a 16-year-old kid, and it's one of the most beautiful jobs I've ever read of reporting. Have you ever been in a tornado? Well, a tornado is like time. A tornado is undefeatable. A tornado is one of those elements of nature that man has never yet learned how to control and never will. And the only thing he can ever do in a tornado is do what they have done since time immemorial in Kansas. Dig a hole and hang on and pray. That's all they've been able to do about it. Are you aware of that? Well, listen to this. This kid writes to me from Toledo. This is a little kid. And I've gotten a letter from this kid about once a year. He is now 16. Dear Gene Shepherd, we have just had a tornado. One struck here in a 3-mile area 2 days ago. It was the first one I've been in, and it left me thinking about things a little differently. My grandma and I were alone in the house when the storm started. We didn't think much about it because it storms all the time anyway here in the summer. I was standing in the front door, leaning on the screen, when the wind hit. It got stronger and stronger. I could hardly close the front door. Drapes and papers were flying around the room. Then the hail started, and more wind. All the outside was white with black things smashing the side of the house. Suddenly, the wooden board on the ceiling sucked up into the attic. My ears plugged. I couldn't hear a thing. I ran into the kitchen and yelled, "Grandma, get on the floor!" She dropped down, and I opened the kitchen door, and the air rushed out like a huge vacuum. It screamed. I lay on the floor, holding the door open. The hail banged on the metal awnings. It seemed to go on forever. Funny, I wasn't shaking. I just stayed there. I wondered what it would be like to die then. The wind slowed down, but the hail came harder. We both got up. We talked kind of funny-like. Gee, I guess it was a big one. Yeah, I guess so. We looked out of the steamed windows. Everything was changed outside. Stuff was gone. It was all white. I grabbed an umbrella and I ran out down the sidewalk. The water and the hail ran over into my shoes. I didn't care. I looked at the house. We had everything except shingles. Trees were tipped over. Globs of roots and dirt were hanging in midair. A baby blackbird was up to its beak in slush. I picked it up and set it down on the drive. Dozens of other birds were dead in the hailstones and were thick on the lawn. A thick, heavy, moist fog was coming up from the ground. The temperature was 80 degrees before the storm, and now it was a refrigerator. It was close to freezing. I ran down the street with that sick, nervous energy that hasn't even left me yet, and it's 3 days ago. Trees were everywhere, mostly on the roads, like a jungle, grew up in the middle of the streets. I'd never seen anything like this. You couldn't use a car or even a bicycle. All the neighbors had spewed out. Everyone was in the same boat. Neighbors we hadn't talked to in years seemed like brothers. Electric wires were down like so many antennas all over the street, just like a great spider web. A man just got out of his new car that was flattened by a tree as big around as five men. I ran home and for some reason got my camera and took pictures of everything. It was like a dream. The thick, cold fog just continued to rise out of the ground. The main highway was sealed off for 3 blocks. Nothing but telephone poles, wires, leaves, limbs, giant oaks and elms. A thick telephone cable, like a gigantic worm, came up out of the street throwing up millions of fine hair wires. A neighbor was crying because his garden was gone, picking up branches 2 blocks of his home, saying, "I might as well take him home. It's my tree." Windows gone. A house and a garage caved in. No birds singing. There weren't any. You could smell green things all over. It smelled like a greenhouse. I ran and I looked until everything just looked the same. It would have been more real if it had been on TV. I went home, exchanged rumors and exaggerations with the neighbors. The trees that were still up had no leaves, like fall. They looked like they were all in my yard, a gigantic drift of leaves. "It'll take me a week to rake them all up," I said to my grandma. I started a fire in the grill so that we could have a hot meal. It didn't hit town at all. A man on the radio said, "Well, someone told me it was raining. I hope it stops before I go home. Now here is a nice selection by..." My God, where was the dynamic news scope flash reporting? The radio wasn't even talking about it. We were living in the real world and they never even mentioned it. I was a wreck. You know, it's kind of a funny thing for a kid to say that, but I guess punk kids can be wrecks too, like grown-ups. We cooked in the fog on a grill standing in 3 inches of hailstones like baseballs. The dog crunched them and ate them. I had never seen a dog eat ice. After eating, I had to get out of the house. We just sat in the dark living room staring at each other by candlelight while the portable radio played some disgustingly slow, sweet music by Mantovani. I went into my bedroom. I got a few cigarettes from their secret hiding place and for the first time smoked in front of my grandma. It was cold, and it was black, the blackest, loneliest night I ever saw. Just a few flickers of yellow from houses that were hidden by fallen trees. And you could see the candles behind the words. And I walked on and on. As I was finishing the last puffs of my weed, another kid who I'd never seen before came up to me, and a conversation followed. He was from Detroit, 15. His grandfather lost all his crops, and we talked about it. We walked up and down the streets, just talking. I'd never seen this kid. We just talked about things, and finally I said, "Thanks for walking around with me." We sat down on a cold sewer, and we just sat there and could smell rubber burning. And then I got up and walked alone down the black street and over the fallen debris. It was quiet. It makes you wonder.